from WNBC-TV, this is News 4 New York.
Good evening, I'm Jack Cafferty. Chuck's off tonight. Thousands of demonstrators demand that New York City do more to help those suffering from AIDS.
All were angry and many were frightened, and they converged on City Hall demanding and pleading, and more than 200 were hauled off to the Station House. News 4's Gay Pressman reports from the scene.
Do you think you've really accomplished a great deal?
Yes, I think we do. What else can we do? I've done everything. I've called everybody. I've had appointments with everybody. I've got to come to City Hall and state my case. We're dying. The city is dying.
For each of the artists, it started with a death. Someone close to them, a partner, a friend, died from a terrifying new disease. There was no help, no meds, no cure. And no one seemed to care. Politicians ignored the sick and dying, or even explicitly said they deserved it. Doctors and nurses refused the disease, quarantining or completely leaving patients alone to die. Even people in the community refused to acknowledge or discuss the new reality. And that was enraging. When would it stop? How would it stop? Would it stop?
Plague! We are in the middle of a plague! 40 million infected people is a plague!
A few men started gathering in the West Village, just to talk about this new reality, to cry about their lost loves, to admit their fears and hopes and deep, unrelenting anger. And then, they couldn't be silent anymore. How did a handful of artists kickstart and script a seismic shift in AIDS awareness and policy? How did their creative skills drive a movement? And what can we learn from the story of Grand Fury about how to make art as resistance today and tomorrow? From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about channeling our rage into creation and using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, podcaster, and queer Gen X woman raised under the specter of AIDS. I've been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the weird art and help others do the same. In 1984, just a few years into the AIDS crisis, Avram Finkelstein lost his partner to AIDS. He was devastated, and he was also scared. Could he have the disease too? No tests existed yet, and even if they did, a positive diagnosis would just be a death sentence, since no treatments were available. Avram's friend Jorge Socarrás had also just lost his partner. As the cases had tripled and tripled again each year, he'd kept a list of his friends that died. By the time it reached 100, he was desperate for something to change. Avram and Jorge started meeting for dinner, to get out of their apartments, to talk about their grief, to feel human for a few hours, and to talk about the disease in ways they hadn't done before. Avram and Jorge talked with disbelief, with confusion, and with anger about the misinformation everywhere, the complete lack of any treatment, or even hope for one. They talked about how Jesse Helms and other politicians said the gays deserved what they got. They talked in frustration about how even other gay men wanted to ignore what was happening. Over time, a few more men started showing up to dinner. By mid-1985, a small group were having regular potlucks. At each dinner, the conversation grew. The anger grew. AIDS was consistently being portrayed in the media as a gay disease. And the potluck group saw how this lifted the veil from the barely veiled homophobia among politicians, doctors, and everyday Americans. Queer rights in the U.S. had been on a massive whiplash through the 20th century. In the 1920s and 30s, queer actors, artists, and musicians were often the ultimate celebrities, part of a so-called pansy craze. Then, just a few years later, the Lavender Scare of the 1950s swung hard to the right as the U.S. government worked to root out all queer people from their jobs, their homes, even their lives. In the 1960s, the civil rights and feminist movements encouraged the queer community, and particularly trans women, to fight back against police raids and discrimination at the Stonewall Inn in 1969. After that, the 1970s showed some loosening around laws and opinion of queer Americans. But in 1980, Ronald Reagan became president on the back of the evangelical right, bringing with him a wave of religious and corporate repression. There was a massive backlash to the women's rights movement, to civil rights, to workers' rights, and to any understanding or acceptance of gay Americans. The resulting environment was one that seems very familiar to today. This is an actual clip from the Reagan administration's press room in 1982. In 1981, the first New York Times article about the disease talked about a rare cancer seen in 41 homosexuals. The disease didn't have a name, let alone a test. And as it spread quickly among gay men, but also intravenous drug users, no clear information was coming from either the government or the medical establishment about how to stay safe. The CDC figured out transmission came only from unprotected sex or contaminated needles, but that message got lost in religious paranoia and the game of politics, which meant that as thousands got sick and died, instead of spreading the word about condoms and needle exchanges, America freaked the fuck out about kissing, touching, even passing AIDS on a toilet seat. As Avram and the group often discussed, the response to the AIDS crisis up to 1985 showed clearly where they stood. ACT UP leader Peter Staley.
It was going to decimate queer America.
Soon, the potluck group didn't want to just talk. They wanted to make something. They all had backgrounds in visual arts, graphics, even advertising and marketing. So they decided to make a poster, a powerful tool in a vibrant poster city like 1980s New York. A poster could be pasted up onto every construction site, every community board, every space they could think of around the city. In a pre-internet world, a poster would be a powerful way to not only express their anger and grief, but also reach out to others. Around this time, conservative columnist William Buckley wrote a column for the New York Times where he proposed that all AIDS victims be tattooed on the arm and buttocks. As often happens in the lunacy of today's media environment, the idea actually gained traction.
How deeply are Americans worried about AIDS? A Los Angeles Times poll found that 50% of Americans favor quarantine for AIDS victims. 15% said AIDS victims should be tattooed.
One of the members of the potluck group had recently visited Dachau, the Nazi concentration camp. And he knew that during the Holocaust, queer people were marked with a pink triangle and systematically executed. After a long creative workshop, the team produced a poster that was almost all black. In the center, pink triangle. At the bottom, in huge letters, were the words, "Silence equals death." Here's Avram from a 2009 interview.
We worked for 9 months on this poster, and we studied every aspect of every turn of phrase. We argued about the color, the exact color of the pink on the triangle. Every single aspect of it had meaning and was packed with meaning for us. Institutionally, silence is about control. Personally, silence is about complicity. And I think as a Jew, and there were three of us were Jews, this was tremendously disturbing to us. Because to a Jew, when you see something happening and you're silent about it, you're participating in it, whether you want to or not, whether you know it or not.
The team paid for the poster to be reproduced and plastered over as much of the village and key spots in the city as it could. They wanted it to be a signal, a symbol, and a sign to take action. Not long after the Silence Equals Death posters went up in early 1987, the potluck group attended a speech from activist Larry Kramer. Other small political groups were also in attendance, and some of them started talking about these posters they were seeing around the city. Avram and the group admitted it was their work, and they received a round of excited applause. And suddenly, everyone started discussing the creation of a new group dedicated to AIDS protests and action. They called it ACT UP. ACT UP is the truly excellent acronym for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Their goals were protests and demonstrations that hit at the centers of power to drive action where there was none. And from the start, they used the creative work of the potluck group, soon to be named Grand Fury. In their first protests, ACT UP produced the Silence Equals Death message everywhere. Placards, t-shirts, buttons, signs, and they encouraged Grand Fury to do more. In the 1987 Pride Parade, there were many floats advertising local cabarets and bars, with stripped-down men dancing to club music. Grand Fury members Mark Simpson and Michael Neslin decided to stand out. They created a float that drew the theme of silence equals death further. They made it to look like a concentration camp. They strung barbed wire between 2x4s, encircling ACT UP members that wore their pink triangles. They set up a guard tower with a man in a Ronald Reagan mask pointing and laughing at the camp. The scene was completed with ACT UP members circling the float in masks and gloves, like police officers were doing at the time. They handed out flyers about the next ACT UP meeting. At first, the float was followed by just a small group of ACT UP members shouting, "ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS." And as the float passed through the village, spectators started joining them. By the end of the parade, the tail for the float spread over 6 blocks. And at the next ACT UP meeting, hundreds of new people showed up, ready to fight. Shortly after the parade, Mark, Michael, and new members Donald Moffat and Tom Kalin worked on a museum window display. They conceived of a mock trial they called Let the Record Show. They made placards with images of Reagan, a member of his HIV commission, Buckley of the tattoo column, Jesse Helms, who shouted for quarantine, Jerry Falwell of General Evangelical Fuckery, and an anonymous surgeon. They made concrete slabs with these people's worst and most homophobic quotes. And in Reagan's case, the slab just showed an ellipsis to show his silence. They topped the display off with the pink triangle and a running news ticker with silence equals death. In 1988, as George H.W. Bush was running his presidential campaign using the phrase, "Read my lips, no new taxes," Grand Fury made posters that showed men kissing with the headlines, "Read my lips." The text below reminded viewers that kissing did not pass AIDS. Later, they made a massive bus ad featuring three couples kissing, two gay men, two lesbian women, and a straight couple. The text said, "Kissing doesn't kill. Greed and indifference do." There was more. More posters, more ads, designed to shock, to provoke, to excite. Over the next few years, Grand Fury made a number of new projects. There was a fake New York Times front page showing the actual news about the AIDS epidemic. There were posters and painted handprints saying leaders had blood on their hands. There were fake dollar bills that ACT UP rained down on the New York Stock Exchange, with messages protesting the astronomical price of new AIDS treatments, saying, "Fuck your profiteering." There were signs to accompany a takeover of the CDC, demanding they expand the definition of AIDS to straight women, often infected by closeted men. Women don't get AIDS, they just die from it. And as the years wore on and deaths continued to take ACT UP and Grand Fury members, they even donated their bodies, asking that protesters carry their coffins through the streets. Jack Lowery wrote the comprehensive history of Grand Fury called It Was Vulgar and It Was Beautiful. He says ACT UP is perhaps the most well-branded protest movement ever because of Grand Fury. The artists thought in terms of advertising and marketing and how people would see not only the protesters, but every queer person. Many of them came from advertising agencies or marketing, after all. Grand Fury let the press help spread their message, simply by reporting the news on TV and in the papers, their t-shirts and banners on display. But they also placed their work directly where everyday people would see them. Billboards, subway stations, buses. As their work popped up everywhere, it was clear the members of Grand Fury thought of their posters, banners, and performance art as more than messaging, more than advertising. It was propaganda, designed to sway hearts and minds. Here's Grand Fury member Marlene McCarty speaking in 2012.
It was direct action propaganda. I mean, we were very clear among ourselves that the work was made to be incorporated into direct action, and that we were very clearly making the propaganda we wanted to hear. Especially in the early pieces, they always ended with take direct action, and then there was always something that you as an individual standing on the street reading the stupid poster could do. You could call somebody, you could go to a demo, you could do something.
Instead of thinking that kissing spreads AIDS, understand that it doesn't. Instead of thinking women don't get AIDS, understand that they do. Instead of staying quiet or going back in the closet, speak out, even if it's the last actions you take in life. And instead of thinking queer people deserve AIDS, understand empathy.
While you're at it, why don't you open the tryouts? Because a line of people you refuse goes on for miles. We got women with AIDS, believe it, please. You haven't heard of pelvic inflammatory disease. We got babies and children dying for drugs they help just fine. You ain't trying. We got people of color with nowhere to go. Do your trials address their needs? No. We got IV drug users in need of the same as everyone else. And this created tenemos gente que no comprende ni idioma que hablan. Apoyo no se entiende.
It's often hard to measure the impact of art. But because Grand Fury was tied so closely to an organization dedicated to action, there were clear wins. Here's Sarah Schulman, author of Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, in a 2021 interview.
ACT UP forced pharmaceutical companies and the government to change the way they researched medications for AIDS. ACT UP forced the Food and Drug Administration to make experimental drugs available to people who were sick, even if they had not been approved. ACT UP stopped the Catholic Church when they tried to interfere with condom distribution in the public schools. ACT UP ran a four-year campaign to make sure that women with AIDS could get benefits and get access to experimental drugs. And really, ACT UP transformed how queer people and people with AIDS felt about themselves and how we were represented in the mainstream media.
And beyond these massive shifts in policy and perception, Grand Fury members often heard of personal, individual impact of their work. Here's Grand Fury member Robert Vasquez Pacheco speaking in 2012.
I was working for a national AIDS organization, so I was traveling all around the country, and I would see this poster and a variety of in gay bars or in offices. And one of the things that Grand Fury did, that the image became something that was almost in some ways universal. It became such a positive image for folks. I don't know how many people will come up to me and say, you know, I've had that picture up on my refrigerator for years, and you know, this is one of the first things that I got when I was coming out of the closet. And so it was really sort of, that made me feel good to understand that Fury had done something beyond what we intended to do.
That's one of the beautiful things about art as resistance. It helps you see yourself. It helps you save yourself in the midst of moments that try to destroy you. What can we learn from Grand Fury? What can we do as creative people in this fucked up world? Because we are all creative, we can all find ways to resist. Grand Fury work wasn't necessarily about artistic excellence. Every member took pride in their work, and they brought some artistic experience to the work. But the goal wasn't to create art that would be shown in galleries or spoken of as artistic mastery. The goal was to speak directly to people. Grand Fury wanted to shift how queer people were seen. They wanted to help drive movement to help queer people survive. So they used the resources they could find, called in the favors they could, made the work that wasn't perfect but was good enough. And perhaps most importantly, they gave themselves a way to transform their grief and anger, to channel their pain, to not just survive, but to live. For me, the lesson from Grand Fury is that art can be an extremely powerful tool of resistance and change, especially paired with a movement, but it can also be a life-saving tool for the creators themselves. There's another lesson from Grand Fury. Progress gets pulled back. The wild swings of public perception continued after the 80s and 90s. And here we are, 40 years later, in the midst of another massive backlash, with a government that cares little for anyone that isn't rich, white, straight, with leaders and commentators and religious organizations that preach the end of the queer community. So here's what we do from here. We understand the power of using our voice and making our art for our own survival. We look for the people we can collaborate with, create with, commiserate with. And we don't think of this as short term. Even if we get a new administration down the road, even if we miraculously come out of this terrifying, tyrannical moment, there is so much to fight against and for. We go into this, into making art as resistance, as a long-term commitment to making art for a better world. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At artofresistance.space, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Here's an easy way to learn more about Art as Resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at artofresistance.space and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.